Good afternoon and welcome to another great edition of How Bette Davis Saved My Life. Life lessons from classic Hollywood, and I am Moya, and as always, I have my faithful companion here with me, none other than your name, ma'am?
Georgia.
Georgia, yes. So, Georgia, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Moya.
And we were talking a little early, and you said you had an uneventful New Year, and that's just how you wanted it.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, Georgia and I, we are exciting gals, but you know, you got to prioritize your excitement at this point in the game. You got to pick your battles, if you would pick your parties. Pick your party. We don't call it a battle. Pick your parties. Pick your poison. There you go. So yeah, we are here, and we kind of wanted to start the new year off with Bette. But the way it shook down on our calendar, our schedule, Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas, that actually was our first movie of the new year, which is perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. A great movie. But this will be our first Bette Davis movie of the year, Dead Ringer. Dead Ringer. And so Georgia had not seen it, and I didn't either know you hadn't seen it, or I forgot you hadn't seen it. And so when she came back and was like, this is like, thank you for suggesting this movie. And I was like,
why you picked such a great movie?
And I'm like, I thought you'd seen it before. That is hilarious. So this is Bette Davis circa 1964. And this is her second time playing a set of twins. The first one was with Glenn Ford. I don't remember the year, but almost like 20 years ago in Stolen Life. And that's a real good one. We'll get to that one. We have to get to that one. That's a really good one. But yeah, this is Dead Ringer, 1964. So Georgia, I'm gonna, as always, give you first crack at it, give you first honors. Tell me what you thought. Give us some information about Dead Ringer.
Well, Dead Ringer is a classic. It's camp. It's
yes,
fun. It's
yes.
a thriller. And you know, Bette Davis was just fresh off her success in 1962 of playing Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
Yes.
When she did this movie. And this movie, there was a Warner Brothers ad. They were famous for building up their star, Bette Davis. And they said, nobody's as good as Bette when she's bad.
And, that's wonderful.
You know, and I thought to myself, what could be more fun than, what could be better than Bette Davis in a movie?
Bette Davi. Would that be the plural? I don't know.
So this, but you know, if you like a movie with a twist ending, and you know, and you got to realize this is one of her comeback movies that she did in the '60s when she was like reinventing herself, her new career.
Right.
And Bette Davis plays a dual role. Okay. I'm only going to give you about maybe one, maybe two sentences. That's it. The plot. Bette Davis plays evil twins. One is rich, the other one's poor, and they both wanted the same man, and that's all I'm going to tell you.
There you go.
But that is so rich right there, with if you think of all the possibilities. Bette Davis plays both Margaret DeLorca and Edith Phillips, and the wonderful, talented Carl Malden plays her detective boyfriend. His name is Jim Hobson. And then we also have Peter Lawford.
Yes, it's a hodgepodge. It's a hodgepodge. It's so random. Look, the cast is so freaking random, and on paper it should not work. But it is a buffet of absolute camp and over the top and just greatness. Just greatness.
It is. I know. It's like, and you, hey, this, we're going to get into that a little bit later. But I wanted to tell you, the person who is directing her is her great friend and former co-star, Paul Henreid.
Yes.
Paul Henreid starred with her in Now Voyager and also Deception. And he understood Betty, and there was such a mutual admiration for each other. And I think he does a brilliant job as a director in this movie. And, you know, he was also in Casablanca.
Right.
So remember this, Paul Henreid. And Paul Henreid's daughter also plays Janet, the mm-hmm. maid in this movie, very well, I might add. So, yes, like you just said, it's such a hodgepodge of people in this movie, but it all comes together. Just such a wonderful piece of film. And so I wanted to say that there was another star who was considered for the lead role. Lana Turner. But Lana Turner turned the role down because she didn't want to play twins.
Couldn't play. There's a difference. Ma'am, you not want to, or you could not? Yes, that is shade. Intentional shade.
Yes, indeed. I agree with you. Throw some shade. Anyway, but Betty Davis declined a role. She was offered a role in the movie Four for Texas in 1963, and she chose to do this film instead. And I'm glad that she
did. I know. Thank goodness.
Yes. And there's also a lady who plays a good friend of hers, and she just kind of blows in. She's kind of like this crazy over-the-top friend, played by actress Jean Hagen.
Yes, yes.
And this was Jean Hagen's last film.
Really?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Did she die, or she just retired?
She died. She was 54 when she died. She died in 1977, but this was her last film.
Mm.
And you have to understand a little bit about Peter Lawford, because some of, like, Moya and I know this, but some of y'all might not know, because you're a little, you know, I mean, you might know some of the connections here, but Peter Lawford was President John F. Kennedy's brother-in-law.
Right.
Some of y'all probably know that if you really follow movies and stars. But anyway, I think we should just, you know, we can go ahead with some more on the movie, because I've got a lot more to say and a lot more trivia on this movie. I found this movie to be uproarious good fun, Moya, and I just wanted to say, you really know how to pick them, girl.
It's not me, it's Betty. Like you said, thank you, Betty, for doing this film, and because those of us who are fans of hers, and I don't know, you know, didn't see any trivia about her doing this because she had done A Stolen Life, so she felt comfortable. Now, I'm speculating that may have a part in it, but it adds to the legend of Betty Davis, because it was such a meaty role, and she knew she could do it. Obviously, she had done it before, so that was not a problem. And this was a year before The Nanny, that British thriller, like they call them hag thrillers, which is so mean. Like Baby Jane and this and like Joan Crawford and that movie where she had the axe, I forget. But anyway, they're like hag thrillers, okay? But The Nanny, which was, I love that. Have you seen The Nanny, Georgia?
I saw it when I was a little kid and I recorded it.
We're going to get to that one. Yeah, we have to get to that one.
It's coming up on TCM and I'm going to see The Nanny. I haven't seen it since I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
That's really what got me started on Betty Davis.
Oh, really?
Brother and sisters, and we would have an evening to ourselves as kids, and we would watch these Betty Davis films, and that's how I first got to see her, was during her...
Y'all were very sophisticated.
...exploitation period, you know?
Right, very, so, very smart.
But you know, one of the things that I find kind of interesting, and maybe this is a little bit off the tracks, but guess how old Betty Davis was when she made this movie?
How old?
She was 56.
Okay, but, really?
And her makeup man had a special process that he used. And yeah. They called it painting on the makeup. And this is what gets me is that back in those days, actresses, Bette Davis looks, I'm not being mean, I'm not being cruel, but you'll notice the difference in the way actresses are now. If you look at people like Helen Mirren, or if you look at like Jane Fonda, Meryl Streep, Diane, some of these mm-hmm. other right. actresses, you know, they look different, even though they're playing these older women roles. And women back then, they didn't age as well in movies. And
right.
Bette Davis here, she actually looks older than her 56.
I would have never given her 56. She looks like she's 60 something, 62 at least. Yeah. But the smoking and the drinking and the lifestyle, you know, the stress of Hollywood, it was, and that's how everybody lived. And she always said she did none of that. She said she was a virgin before she got to Hollywood. She didn't drink
That's
or
right.
smoke. So
it's
the wear and tear. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I have an interesting bit of trivia about the cigarettes she smokes in this movie.
Oh.
She smokes 16 cigarettes.
Oh,
in this movie.
My gosh.
Yes.
Ugh.
Yes.
Ugh.
But it is part of the character she plays, but still,
she was a smoker.
Somebody did. She was a smoker. Yes, and you can hear it in her voice too.
Oh yeah, I mean, even when she was on interviews, when you could smoke, you know, on television, on live television, like on a talk show, whatever, like Dick Cavett, she would light up as you know, who knows what they edited, but she, you could see her going through at least 3 cigarettes during an interview. You know, when she would be on, you know, back in those days. So at least you could count at least 3. So. And I don't care, internet trolls, whatever. Smoking looked cool. Everybody did it. You know, now it's a sin to smoke or whatever. It's so crazy. You know, you want to kill people, cancel people because they smoke. But, I mean, it's what people did. My family, my grandmother smoked. My mom didn't smoke. She tried it, but she looked utterly ridiculous. But my grandmother smoked. But I didn't, and, you know, we picked it up because we, you know, you want to play like you could smoke when you were kids. And, but you know, we never picked it up because as kids, we always knew that was for adults, you know, and then mm-hmm. because I never wanted to smoke, you know, you just would try it because that's what kids do. But when I heard my grandmother complaining about the price of cigarettes and beer going up, and I was like, I ain't smoking, that's expensive. I'm like, so that kind of deterred me from smoking because I didn't realize cigarettes ain't free. But Georgia, and I know we're getting off track, it was growing up as a kid was so much fun. It's not how it is now. You need everybody's approval, the government and your mom, your third removed cousin and everybody on social media, and you looking for approval for how you parent. We'd have been taken away from our parents. But Georgia, do you remember the candy cigarettes? Did you have those?
Yeah.
Girl, and who bought them for us? Who bought them? My mother. Bought the candy cigarettes, the cap guns, and these cap guns didn't have the orange barrel like now. Well, they don't even make them anymore. Well, some places, you know, but they're obviously not a real gun. Girl, we could have been, the cops could have shot us and we'd have died with a cigarette, a candy cigarette now. Because we had all, and it was fun. I love those damn candy. They still make them. One of the liquor stores around here, they have them as novelties. And I bought me and Warren some not too long ago. And girl, we were smoking.
Wish I'd been there.
I'm going to get you a pack of candy cigarettes. Because it tastes like peppermints.
During this pandemic.
I will. Oh, I know. Just smoking. And so we had them hanging from our lip. You know how you look cool talking with them hanging from your lip. All right, so I'm sorry I got off the path, but we turned out okay. I didn't even want to smoke. We turned out perfectly fine. So I'm sorry, y'all. We're back. So, Georgia.
Okay. But one of the things that I love about this movie is this is the full-on Bette Davis. Because,
yes.
You know, she will puff and she'll pout. The eyes will pop. I mean, she's got all the expressions. And then, you know, when her sister visits her, that line, she says, dump.
That's one of her favorite, one of her favorite lines of all time, a dump.
And that just cracked me up so much. And you know, there's some things in this movie, but I want to say, Moya, did you notice the difference in how she smooches the gigolo guy in contrast with how she smooches with her friend, with Jim, her boyfriend? Did you notice a difference?
Well, I mean, Jim, maybe, go ahead.
I thought maybe, you know, you can tell. I mean, that was such a giveaway, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was like, you know, and I mean, he, you know, it's like, oh boy, you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
That was just one of the things that I liked. But you know, when I was watching this movie, I unintentionally, because it was, I love camp.
Right.
But I was thinking, you know, this is just like with the swapping of the clothes and the hairstyle.
Uh-huh.
It's just like the Parent Trap, except it's deadly.
Right, right. This is the adult version of Parent Trap. You're right. It is.
But anyway, I just thought this movie, and then did you notice that harpsichord music that they would play in 60s?
Oh, yes, yes.
That corny.
Music. I love it. It's so corny and over the top. Guys, if you love camp, or you want to get introduced to camp, quality camp, start with Dead Ringer with Bette Davis. Because it is quality camps. You know, some camp is just, you know, just poorly done and is rushed and poor editing production. No, this is quality. So
is.
As Georgia said, you know, now, you know, we hate spoilers. And this movie is riddled. It's a landmine of spoilers. So we are going to really tread lightly here. So Georgia said, like she said, they're twin sisters. Edie is the poor one, the country mouse, if you will. I'm trying really hard, George. So there is a lot of lies and deception that has led Edie to live the life she has, which isn't a bad life in the grand scheme of things, and led Maggie, the city mouse, or the rich twin, to lead her life. So Edie has this club cocktail lounge, and we would say Carl Malden, he's a cop, and he, you know, his character, and he is crazy about Edie. He's on the verge of retirement. He wants her to retire with him, and they're going to go start an egg farm. And so he has all these wonderful, wonderful, wonderful plans for her. Edie is in financial dire straits. She's a lot of pressure on her because she's very free-hearted and everything like that. And so I'm really trying hard, Georgia, not to go into these landmines. But I want to talk about the cocktail club for a moment, because in there, there's a jazz combo of two black people. Perry Lee Blackwell is on that funky organ. And let me get the gentleman's name. I just had it. Kenny Dennis, he's on the drums, and he is a famous, well, I ain't gonna say famous, but a very popular, what they call a side man. So he's played with Miles Davis. He's played with anybody who's anybody. Just anybody in the jazz greats world. He's played with them. And then we also found out that Perry Lee Blackwell, she was singing in Pillow Talk, 1959 Pillow Talk with Rock Hudson and Doris Day. So I just want to point that out. So, and Georgia, did you recognize when they came in and the music started, it was perfect timing, because Edie had just got the bad news, you're behind on your rent, we're going to kick you out. And then boom, they start in with this wild jazz music, and they weren't just there for dressing, because the bartender told Carl Malden's character, you know, she needs to get rid of these music people. She can't afford this, you know, but she was so free-hearted, and the people brought the musicians brought the people in, but you brought in poor people. You didn't buy a lot of liquor.
Yeah.
So, but yeah. I just wanted to bring that out about that jazz trio. These were actual musicians. They were not actors. And I thought that was fascinating. Just a little trivia, music trivia.
But these people were so good.
Yeah.
And like you said earlier, see the same group of people again in the movie Pillow Talk.
Right.
I mean, they were really a thing.
And right.
So don't miss out on this if you want to hear some really contemporary for that time. So
yes.
Wonderful.
Yes. Yes.
This is the place to listen to it.
Right.
And I thought that that was the most classiest thing about her whole establishment.
Right. By right. Far. And you saw a black woman at that time on her own playing the organ. And there's other black female organists and pianists, you know. But and she kind of looked, she was really pretty. She like kind of looked like Diane Carroll and a drummer. He was handsome, too. But for that time, I guess if I was a black person, you know, that's the height of civil rights, I went to this movie and saw these black people. I'd be like, oh, hey, that's cool. You know, and we talked about before we started, Betty Davis was a civil rights I'm not gonna say activist, but she wanted
a proponent.
Yeah, a proponent, right? She was for the black soldiers during World War II, absolutely being included into the Hollywood canteen, and we'll get more into that later at another time. But it was refreshing to see those black people and the stenographer when they were he was taking the notes during the investigation of okay, so now I'm in landmine territory. Can we say there was a murder, or should we say whose murder is it, or should we not be specific?
There is a murder. Yes.
Oh, God. Y'all don't know how hard this is for us not to say.
Actually, there is going to be revealed later on. Yeah.
There's three murders, actually. Let's leave it at that.
One murder.
Right. Well, I mean, can we say it? Because it is a plot point that Okay, we'll just say this. Betty Davis at some point assumes, I'm sorry, Betty, the Edie character, the poor one, the country mouse, at some point assumes her sister, the rich sister's identity. We can say that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I think because that's pretty.
That's general. Yeah, that's important.
That's pretty general.
And honey, be careful what you ask for, because don't she do some hopping and dancing in that woman's life?
Oh my God.
Oh my goodness.
She has to all of a sudden tap dance really.
Oh.
She has to really be on her toes.
Dance, sister, dance.
It's gonna be easy street. Uh-uh.
No, ma'am, Pam. I was like, because I hadn't seen it in a while, and I'd forgotten the details. And I was like, oh, crap. Like, you know, when these things unfold that she did not expect. And she has to do a lot of fakery. She has to burn herself, you guys. She went to extremes to keep this, to keep this ruse.
Yes.
She had to physically harm herself. So we're not giving away too much, but it was a lot. I just want to talk about, you talked about Jean Hagen, and she just chewed up scenery. The clothes, we forgot about the clothes. The clothes were fabulous. I had never heard of this designer, and I wrote down his name, Don Feld. He did all the clothes. He's done a lot in movies. He did Pritzi's Honor, Spaceballs for TV. He did Wonder Woman and just a whole lot of stuff. But I've never heard of him. But the clothes and the jewelry, oh my gosh. Ooh, fan-freaking-tastic.
But didn't he really know how to dress Betty Davis?
Because she had gained weight. He did. She wasn't small, and she always had those boobs, and she was not wearing a bra because I was looking. She was infamous for not wanting to wear a bra. She had gained some weight, and she didn't have the best figure. But didn't he dress her, Georgia? He dressed her to the nines.
He understood her figure.
Yes.
And her personality. And he just really, I was so impressed with the way the clothes had such an elegance and a chicness. And,
yes.
And he knew, he knew how to portray her as Edie, the country mouse sister, and about the rich sister that
right right
married I should say
yes
you know, you're right, that the wardrobe and you know it made me remember way back when women were garter belts and hose, and you had to clip
that's right
and all that. It reminded me of all that. So it was yeah, and I can see why they may have wanted Lana Turner, because there was like this some scenes where she's like doing the clothes changes where they might have considered Lana Turner, but mm-hmm. I'm so glad they chose good old BD instead.
Right,
because you know, it made me laugh through this movie. I thought Betty Davis is upstaging Betty Davis.
That's a perfect way to look at it. Yes.
Because yes. They had a new a process that they were using. It was some sort of, it's trick photography.
Okay.
Because they mm-hmm. had Betty Davis as she and her twin together in the same scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only way they could do it is to use this new method of photography. And they used it earlier in A Stolen Life, but they perfected it. So it's even better and more refined.
Okay.
In this movie here. And you think, no, this is 1964. Look at how
yes,
well
yes.
they put Betty Davis, she and her twin together in the same scenes, and it's played so well. Yes, she did have a double. She
yeah, well, double yeah, right.
Very much like her.
Yeah,
yes,
and right.
Some, and some scenes, you, if you look very carefully, I mean, you
but you have to really, really look, you know, but they pulled it off, in my opinion.
Oh, gosh, did they ever. Did they ever. And that's one of the things that's just, so clever about this movie. And so, you know, I saw this, and there's this one scene though. I don't want to give it away, but it's like full on Betty versus Betty. That's all I'm gonna say. That's
oh, all I'm gonna say. Look, I'ma say it. She Betty Davis cursed her sister out. So I'ma just now, not cussing as we know today, but yes, she cussed her out, and it was delicious. I was hooting. I fell out. I laughed my behind off. I thought she girl, and it was like that's just a testament to that this woman's acting ability, because you were cursing with her. You cursed with her. I felt that cuss in my chest, girl. I totally felt, and I was like, hell yeah, tell that B right now.
Oh, I was waiting for her. But you know what is so amazing about Betty Davis as an actress is because she can play somebody who can be an evil person,
mm-hmm.
and you will see her, you know, she'll be faced, you know, against all these terrible odds against her, and she'll be trapped or whatever, and you are still. I was pulling for her.
Yeah, totally.
I was pulling for you, Betty.
I was.
What you're faced with, my God, the most horrible, awful things you're faced with. But you know, there's something about Betty Davis and her acting and her personality,
right.
Because that's why we love her, because she's bold and she's brazen.
Yes.
And she's indestructible, and no matter how horrible things get for her, you just always want to go, yeah, Betty,
right,
I'm
right
behind you, Betty, you know. And I mean, and you know, and so I love the fact that our podcast is got her name.
Oh, it's definitely Betty. it's an honor we no, go ahead.
I just want to say, you know, I thought this is, if I had to make a recommendation for a movie to watch on a cold winter night, this is the movie.
Oh yeah, yeah. I could watch it at least like quarterly. Look at it, because it's so delicious. It's so good. And then you know what? Look at it with somebody. Look at it with a good friend who would appreciate it or something. It's because this is a fun movie. Like you said, Georgia, this is a absolutely fun movie. We're kind of running out of time here. But we had a lot of great character actors. The lady who played Donna Anna, she is always a hoot whenever you see her. Estelle Winwood, love her. She is always hilarious. Paul Harrison, always enjoyed him. The guy who played the limo driver, I can't see his name. George McCready. George McCready, he was really in like almost every 30s and movies back then, knows a lot. But there was a lot of great, even TV people. The guy who played the Philip Carey, I think that was, played Sergeant Hogue. Just a lot of great, great character actors that you're going to recognize from TV and what have you. I'm gonna just say this real quick. I did not like the ending. I didn't think it was necessary. I think it should have ended with she and the butler on the stairs. They should have left the ending up to the audience, in my opinion.
You know, Moya, I think I would have enjoyed it more. They kind of had to redo the ending. They had to really rewrite this script and rework it.
Okay.
It sat on a shelf for about 20 years before they decided to film it. And Betty Davis said it had to be rewritten quite a bit. But, you know, I would have been happy for it to end that way.
Mm-hmm. I hated the ending.
Yeah, I did too. It's like...
Yeah, don't virtue signal to us. That's how I felt. And I know that it was a Hollywood code and, you know, type of thing. But it didn't ruin it at by any stretch of that imagination. No. But it was like, oh, come, what a cop out. You know, it was a cop out to me. I'm glad I brought that up to get your opinion on it. And that's about it, because if we talk anymore, we're going to start revealing stuff.
So, yeah, boy, I think this is a nice place to end it. So,
okay, yeah. And I know you're chomping at the bit. We really want to talk more about this. So, guys, don't forget, subscribe to our podcast. We're on Facebook at How Betty Davis Saved My Life. Please submit comments. We love your comments. Please keep it classy. Keep it classy, dames and gents. And we would love to get your take on Dead Ringer 1964. Classic, classic, classic. Betty Davis. And Georgia, is there anything you want to say before we totally wrap it up?
No, I think we've said it all. We said it well.
Okay, well, guys, thank you for tuning in to another fantastic episode of How Betty Davis Saved My Life, Life Lessons from Classic Hollywood. I am Moria.
And I'm Georgia.
And you guys have a good one. And we will see you really soon with another great, great film for us to tear apart. Take care.